Good afternoon. I'm Chris Fanta. It's my pleasure to welcome you this afternoon to Asthma Grand Rounds. I'd like to remind you how much we do value your feedback, both about today's presentation and also any ideas that you have for Asthma Grand Rounds format or content or speakers. It would be great. Those of you in the audience, those of you attending by live webcasting, please share with us your thoughts. So it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Craig Hirsch, who's a colleague in our Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine Division here at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's also claimed as part of its own by the Channing Division of Network Medicine. And so he's a pulmonologist, he's an epidemiologist, he's a geneticist, and who better to guide us through a discussion of the interrelationship between asthma and COPD than Dr. Hirsch, who's going to speak to us today on the asthma-COPD overlap syndrome. Dr. Hirsch. Thank you.
So thank you for inviting me here to speak. So here are my disclosures. And this is another disclosure I want to make. Although my picture is on the Partners Asthma Center website, here teaching Dr. Fanta how to read a CAT scan, I'm not an asthma specialist, and I'm really going to come at this presentation from the COPD side of things, and hopefully that will be interesting to the asthma group. So in the spirit of grand rounds, I'm going to start with a case or maybe three cases, but you'll see. So I'm going to present a 65-year-old man who shows up to see you complaining of cough, or usually it's his wife complaining of his cough. Cough is worse when he awakens in the morning, and he's noticed he's been dysmic trying to keep up with his friends on the golf course. Every year for the past 3 or 4 years, he'd needed antibiotics for bronchitis, past medical history of hypertension, hyperlipidemia. He smoked one pack of cigarettes daily for 40 years and quit 10 years ago. When you examine him, he has reduced breath sounds. You order spirometry, which shows a FEV1 of 60% predicted with a reduced FEV1-FVC ratio. And there's no improvement in his spirometry with albuterol. So what's your diagnosis? And this is not a trick question. COPD. I don't think we have any disagreement about that. So here's another case, or maybe part of the first case. A 10-year-old boy presents to you with a cough. Coughs worse at night. He's becoming dyspneic and can't keep up with his friends in soccer practice. He's needed prednisone for, quote, bronchitis annually for the past 3 or 4 years. And his past medical history is notable for eczema and allergic rhinitis. When you examine him, he has a few wheezes. His peak flow is reduced, but improves somewhat with albuterol. So your diagnosis here, again, quite straightforward. Asthma. I don't think there's any debate about that one. So here's the third case, and maybe a different case or not. So a 65-year-old man now presents to you with a cough. It's worse both at night and awakening in the morning. Still has dyspnea trying to keep up with his friends in the golf course, and he still needed the antibiotics for bronchitis every year for the past 3 or 4 years. But now his past history is notable for seasonal allergic rhinitis, and he remembers having asthma as a kid and being dyspneic at sports practice and seeing an astute doctor in the Partners Asthma Center who told him he had asthma at that point. He smoked a pack of cigarettes daily for 40 years, quit 10 years ago. Obviously, you can tell I reused a lot of these snippets. And on exam, still has reduced breath sounds with reduced FEV1 and FEV1-FVC ratio. But his FEV1 improves 10% following inhaled albuterol. So what is your diagnosis? So is it COPD or asthma or some combination of the two? That's what we'll talk about for the rest of this talk. So here's an outline of what I'd like to discuss. Since this is the Asthma Center Grand Rounds, I'm going to give a brief introduction to COPD, since that's not something generally covered in this time. Introduce the concept of COPD subtypes. Talk about the asthma-COPD overlap subtype and our research into this in the COPD gene study. And talk about some clinical implications and some treatment and management guidelines. So here's the introduction. So this is the definition of COPD from the GOLD document, the Global Initiative for Chronic Obstructive Lung Disease, and their website is listed here, which has a wealth of information about COPD. I'm not going to sit here and read this definition, but we will go through some highlights of it. So COPD is common. That's the first part of this definition. So how common is it? According to the third National Health and Nutrition Examination Study, performed by the CDC in 2002 showed that there's 12 million adults, or estimated 12 million adults in the United States diagnosed with COPD, and another 12 million have undiagnosed airflow obstruction consistent with COPD. This has been recently updated in the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey from the CDC, which shows that the number of diagnosed adults may actually be closer to 15 million. So there are potentially 27 million people in the United States with this disease. The BRFSS also went on to show state-by-state estimates of disease, showing the highest incidence here in Kentucky and the lowest incidence in Utah and Massachusetts, somewhere in the middle. So COPD, part of the definition, involves persistent airflow limitation. And this is a slide that I show whenever I talk about COPD to students or house staff or any other groups. And if you remember one thing that I told you today, it's that spirometry is absolutely essential for the diagnosis of COPD. Dr. Tom Petty, not the Tom Petty you're thinking of, who was one of the fathers of American pulmonary medicine, has been known to say, or had been known to say, diagnosing COPD without spirometry is like diagnosing hypertension without measuring the blood pressure. So I think we should think about spirometry as an absolute essential part of this diagnosis. And here are just some examples of normal spirometry and an obstructed spirometry consistent with COPD. So COPD is associated with a chronic inflammatory response in the airways and in the lungs. And here are some pathology pictures of COPD. We think of one of the classic pathologies of emphysema, loss of the alveolar attachments here, an enlargement of the air spaces surrounding the central airway. Mucus metaplasia is a feature of chronic bronchitis, and you see this large blob of mucus obstructing this airway here. And then the hyperplasia of the mucus glands in this picture highlighted in red. And small airways disease is also an important pathology in COPD, shown right here with inflammation in the epithelial walls. Some smooth muscle hypertrophy, but not nearly to the same extent that may be seen in asthma. So COPD is preventable, and the reason it's preventable is it's largely due to noxious particles and gases, and that's sort of code word in the gold speak. And that noxious particles and gases in the developed world is cigarette smoke. And here are some celebrities who've had been diagnosed with COPD with their cigarettes in hand. So Johnny Carson, Dean Martin, and Norman Rockwell, all of whom died of COPD. And Leonard Nimoy, who recently stated that he has COPD and was made a lot of news in the fall. In other parts of the world, there are other exposures that may be more important. But for the most part, and for the sake of our discussion today, in the United States, we're talking about tobacco smoke. So the concept of COPD subtypes I want to introduce you to. So I already showed you three different pathology slides from COPD, so emphysema, large airway disease, and small airway disease, all of which can lead to this airflow obstruction. So COPD is not just this, although spirometry is essential, COPD is not just spirometry airflow obstruction. There's other processes that we have to think about. So this is one of my obligatory network medicine slides. From a paper by Dr. Silverman and Lascalzo here at the Brigham, showing this complex disease perspective, a network medicine to complex, a perspective to complex diseases, including both biological samples, which we'll talk a little bit about today, but more the phenotyping and using various phenotyping methodologies to come up with subtypes of disease. Although our division chief at the Channing and our department chair like to think they've invented disease subtyping, this has actually been around in COPD since the 1950s when Ben Burroughs introduced it and nicely summed up in these drawings by Frank Netter of the classic pink puffer, the thin emphysematous with man with normal oxygen saturation. And in the 1950s and 60s, only men got COPD, so that was the picture. Compared to the blue bloater on the other side, the overweight hypoxemic, that's why he's blue, the chronic bronchitic. And obviously these are extremes, but this paradigm has really held in textbooks to this day. So COPD subtyping has been revisited in more recent years. In 2008, Steve Renard and Jorgen Vespo, two world leaders in COPD, wrote an editorial that COPD should actually be classified as an orphan disease because there's so many different subtypes to it. John Riley here at the Brigham wrote, if you're sort of more mathematically inclined, wrote this equation, and I'm sure Ed Ingenito had some part of this, or at least indirectly, showing that COPD is a sum of some small diseases that we call COPD. And this heterogeneity in diseases, this concept of heterogeneity in disease has objective data to show that, and this is an example from the ECLIPSE study, and I'm not going to go through all these figures, but just highlight one example here. This is 6-minute walk distance plotted against lung function, FEV1. So you can see that there is a linear relationship with declining exercise capacity, with declining lung function, but there's a lot of scatter around that line. And there are some subjects with very severe airflow obstruction who have relatively preserved exercise capacity, and some subjects with near normal lung function that have very diminished exercise capacity. And that heterogeneity holds true for other COPD features like dyspnea, exacerbations, and quality of life, also shown in this figure. An important subtype of COPD that came out of the ECLIPSE study is the frequent exacerbator in this paper by John Hurst in the New England Journal. This plot shows subjects with no exacerbations, one exacerbation, or two or more exacerbations in the first year of this observational study, and then followed them for the duration of the 3-year study, showing that the subjects in red with more than two or more exacerbations in year one were most likely to have two or more exacerbations in year two and continuing through year three of the study. So marking an important risk factor or a subtype of COPD that can be easily identified by a simple clinical question. CT scans of the chest are an important way that we can address heterogeneity in COPD, just showing what the scan looks like, and takes about 30 seconds or less of a breath hold for the patient, and what normal lungs look like here to contrast with the next few slides. This is a paper that we did several years ago looking at CT scans in subjects from the Boston early onset COPD study, so subjects with very severe airflow obstruction at a young age. This subject here has very reduced lung function and severe destructive emphysema. You can see that there's just no lung markings in this part of the lung. Contrasted with this subject on the other side, who has even more severe airflow obstruction measured by the FEV1, but no emphysema at all on their CT scan. They have mosaic attenuation, which may be consistent with small airways disease, really highlighting these different phenotypes of COPD. We went on to divide the subjects in this early onset COPD study into emphysema predominant and airway predominant disease based on a very rough reading of their CAT scans, and showed that the airway predominant subjects had more asthma-like features, including bronchodilator responsiveness, a trend towards higher IgE level, and a higher incidence of physician-diagnosed asthma. And interestingly, a symptom of wheezing did not reliably distinguish between these two groups. There are other COPD subtypes that have been identified in large COPD studies, including the persistently inflamed COPD subject, which came out of the ECLIPSE study, severe early onset COPD, which I mentioned to you, which has been an interest of Dr. Silverman for quite a while and was recently revisited by Marilyn Foreman in the COPD gene study. And there have been a variety of papers using machine learning or computational approaches to identify COPD subtypes, including this example from Michael Cho trying to identify subgroups of COPD patients in the NET study. Since Dr. Fanta mentioned I have an interest in genetics, I have to also discuss this important genetic subtype of COPD, which is alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which is coded by the SERPINA1 gene on chromosome 14. It's an autosomal recessive cause of lung disease leading to early onset COPD in smokers. And although it's recognized from a both genetic and clinical standpoint, it probably only accounts for 1% of COPD cases in the United States. It's important to recognize just because of not just because of the lung disease, but also because of liver disease. And it is important to identify because there is a treatment available with the intravenous pooled human alpha-1 antitrypsin called augmentation therapy. So overall, the subtypes of COPD besides alpha-1 may affect treatment, and I think that's an important reason to know about them. Upper-low predominant emphysema is an important subtype, may be amenable to lung volume reduction surgery. The subgroup with frequent exacerbations, two or more a year, that we've identified in the that were identified in the ECLIPSE study and other studies can be treated with medications like inhaled corticosteroids, azithromycin, or roflumilast, especially those subjects with chronic bronchitis and frequent exacerbations. And we already discussed alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency and the specific treatment for that. So on to the asthma COPD overlap. So this is the traditional view of asthma and COPD. They're two separate diseases, and there's no overlap in between them. And some form of this table is seen in every textbook, and it even shows up in the GOLD report, comparing the differences between asthma and COPD, including the age of onset of asthma in children, COPD in midlife, and I'm glad that they say 60 and 65 is midlife now. Risk factors of asthma include allergy and family history, contrasting with COPD, where it's really tobacco smoke and other indoor and outdoor air pollution. The inflammation is different in asthma and COPD, with asthma generally characterized by eosinophils, mast cells, and CD4 positive lymphocytes, contrasted with COPD having neutrophils, macrophages, and CD8 positive lymphocytes. The symptoms have been shown to be different in these classic descriptions, with asthma varying day to day, week to week, and tends to be worse at night or early in the morning, with COPD characterized by a slow progressive decline in lung function and worsening of symptoms, and then the reversibility of the airflow obstruction, again, being a hallmark feature in these textbook definitions. But is that really the case? So this is data from the UPLIFT study, which is a large COPD trial of tiotropium, and in the baseline data, this is just showing the response to bronchodilator in all the subjects at the baseline visit, and here is the 15%, or actually it's 12% or greater, is right at the mean here, the median, and then 200 mLs is right here. So those classic cutoffs that we use for bronchodilator response, you can see that a large proportion of COPD patients will meet that criteria for bronchodilator responsiveness in this study, and that's been shown in previous studies as well. So maybe there's some overlapping space in between asthma and COPD, and that's what we're discussing today. So again, this is not a new concept. The Dutch hypothesis has been around since 1961 when Professor Ory proposed it, talking about common host factors for asthma and COPD, and those common host factors including airway hyperresponsiveness and atopy, and they went so far to call this entity chronic nonspecific lung disease so as not to have to differentiate between asthma and COPD. And this is in contrast to the British hypothesis proposed by Fletcher in the late 1950s, which purported that recurrent bronchial infections led to lung function decline and COPD. So there is evidence to support the Dutch hypothesis. We know that airway hyperresponsiveness is a risk factor for accelerated decline in lung function. Airway hyperresponsiveness has been associated with mortality in COPD. Yet there's weaker evidence that atopy may be associated with lung function decline. So again, as a geneticist, and the geneticists in the generation before me were very excited, and genetics would be the answer to the Dutch hypothesis. It would be the host factor that we were looking for. And there were many candidate gene studies in the last decade or two finding overlapping candidate genes for asthma and COPD. But in the more recent genome-wide association study era, there's really been no consistent overlap between the asthma and COPD results. So in the ATS guidelines for COPD in 1995, they sort of took this concept from the Dutch hypothesis and proposed this Venn diagram, including chronic bronchitis, emphysema, asthma, and then this box with airflow obstruction. And I think one of the important things that came out of this was showing that all emphysema and chronic bronchitis don't lead to airflow obstruction. And then they sort of grayed in this area that was COPD, and then there was some overlap with asthma marked here. Joan Soriano did a study trying to actually quantify that overlap using the U.S. NHANES study and the U.K. General Practice Research Database, and showing these proportional Venn diagrams trying to represent the ATS groupings here. The numbers are a bit smaller in the U.K. Database since they didn't have spirometry values available in this study. Since then, many other investigators have tried to quantify the percent overlap or how the frequency of this overlap syndrome between asthma and COPD in countries all over the world. And I think you'll notice from this that there's a wide variety of how this overlap syndrome is defined. So studies that use the self-subject's report of a physician diagnosis will show an overlap percentage of anywhere between 15% to 30%, where database studies using, for example, hospital discharges, health insurance databases, or in the US, the Medicaid database, show some one estimate within that range, but two much higher estimates, really showing the difficulty in diagnosing this overlap condition. Again, a network medicine perspective of this, and this is a really neat website if you're interested. It's from the Barabasi, Laszlo Barabasi lab at Northeastern, and it's the Human Disease Network, and they used Medicare database, and you can type in your favorite ICD-9 code, and it shows what other ICD-9 codes it's linked to in Medicare discharges. And so this is ICD-9, speak for COPD, chronic airway obstruction, is here, and then you'll see that one of the top linked diagnoses is asthma right here, as well as some other things that we would expect, emphysema, pneumonia, bronchitis, et cetera. So even in the Medicare database, there is this overlap, and you can go in and do it, put asthma and see what shows up if the other way around. So why do we care about this asthma COPD overlap syndrome? So we know from a multitude of studies, the patients with this asthma COPD overlap syndrome have more symptoms, use more medications, have more exacerbations, leading to more hospitalizations, and obviously greater healthcare costs due to all of these things. Yet despite this clinical importance, we really have not studied this group well. And we're, you know, like I showed in the previous slide, it's been largely limited to epidemiologic and database studies because subjects with asthma are usually excluded from COPD clinical trials, and subjects with COPD or smokers are usually excluded from asthma clinical trials. The slide of the different prevalences really highlighted a difficulty with the diagnosis of this overlap syndrome. So I think there's some potential here to figure out how to do this better. So doctor's diagnosis is one of the more commonly used diagnostic criteria for the asthma COPD overlap syndrome, and this is what I would call the high throughput phenotyping version of that. But that has also been shown to have a gender bias in a classic study by Chapman and colleagues, showing that given the same clinical data, including spirometry, physicians were more apt to label women with asthma and men with COPD, and that was over 10 years ago, but I think the case may still be the same today. Bronchodilator response is another potential feature we can use to diagnose the asthma COPD overlap syndrome. Blood or sputum eosinophil counts may be another potential, or serum IgE levels, and I think we have to consider both the total and specific IgE levels if we're going to use that, since total IgE levels may be affected by cigarette smoking. So I want to discuss briefly two related subtypes of this of COPD that may be related to the asthma COPD overlap syndrome. And one is atopic COPD, which has gotten more interest recently, highlighted by elevated total and specific IgE levels. And two papers have shown that those subjects have increased symptoms and increased exacerbations compared to non-atopic COPD. Eosinophilic COPD is an increasingly recognized subtype, and authors have shown that up to 40% of subjects will have sputum eosinophilia, stable COPD. But it's thought that the eosinophilic inflammation in COPD may be corticosteroid resistant compared to the eosinophilic inflammation in asthma. And this eosinophilic inflammation may actually increase during acute exacerbations and may be a therapeutic target to both prevent and treat asthma exacerbation, COPD exacerbations. I'm going to discuss our work on the COPD asthma overlap in the COPD gene study. So COPD gene was an observational, or is an observational study. It conducted at 21 clinical centers across the US. Here's us sitting right here. We enrolled over 10,000 smokers with and without COPD and went through a single day study visit, including spirometry, questionnaires, a 6-minute walk test, chest CT scan, and a blood draw for genetic analysis. And we're currently in the process of bringing all the subjects back for a 5-year follow-up visit, repeating the same clinical assessment. So Megan Harden, who's a member of the Asthma Center and a member of the Division of Network Medicine, looked at the first 2,500 subjects that were enrolled in COPD gene, looking at the COPD asthma overlap question. COPD was diagnosed by standard criteria, FEV1 less than 80% predicted with a FEV1-FVC ratio less than 0.7, corresponding to GOLD 2 to 4 stage airflow obstruction. To diagnose asthma, we relied on a subject self-report as a physician diagnosis, but restricted it to subjects who said they were diagnosed before the age of 40 to try to remove the diagnostic bias that may be seen. So in the COPD gene study in the first 2,500, we found that 13% of the COPD subjects reported this overlap syndrome, more commonly among African-American subjects. The subjects with COPD and asthma overlap were younger and had smoked less, but had the same level of airflow obstruction as the subjects with usual COPD. And it's important to note that bronchodilator responsiveness did not differ between these two groups. In keeping with the previous literature, Megan found that subjects with COPD and asthma overlap syndrome had more frequent exacerbations and higher rate of severe exacerbations requiring emergency room visits or hospitalizations compared to subjects with usual COPD. In a follow-up study also led by Megan Hardin that was just published online last week in the European Respiratory Journal, we looked at the full data set after the complete enrollment of the 10,000 subjects and showed that, again, 12% of the COPD subjects had this asthma COPD overlap syndrome. When we looked at the larger sample size, we found that more commonly they were women, and again, the association with African-American race held up. Bronchodilator response using the classic ATS criteria of 12% or 200 mLs was not significantly different between the two groups, but absolute bronchodilator response was statistically significant in this large sample size, but I don't think a difference between 90 mLs and 110 mLs would be a clinically significant difference in bronchodilator responsiveness. The subjects with asthma COPD overlap had worse quality of life measured by higher St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire scores. Again, had an increased rate of exacerbations. They had a higher rate of diagnosis of hay fever and a higher rate of both maternal and paternal asthma, leading us to believe that this really is a real phenotype that we're getting at here. Megan went on to look at the chest CT scans that were performed in all the subjects in COPD gene. So subjects with asthma COPD overlap syndrome had less emphysema on their CT scan, but greater airway disease on the CT scan marked by the wall area of the segmental airways, the subsegmental airways, and the summary measure called the PI-10. However, gas trapping, a potential measure of small airways disease, was not different between these two groups. In the COPD gene study, we went on to do a genome-wide association study using the Illumina OmniExpress chip, which contains slightly less than a million variants, but using statistical imputation, we're able to identify 6 million genetic variants across the genome that we then tested for association with COPD asthma overlap syndrome. We analyzed the non-Hispanic, white, and African-American subjects separately, but combined those results together in a meta-analysis. And here are the top results from the meta-analysis. There was no gene or SNP that met the strict genome-wide significant level at 10 to the minus 8, shown here on these plots, so higher is better, so it's a negative p-value. But there were two genes in the meta-analysis that were interesting at the 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 7 level, the GPR65 gene on chromosome 14, shown here, and CYP11B2 on chromosome 8, shown right here. GPR65 is especially interesting since it's a G protein-coupled receptor involved in eosinophil activation, so a potentially biologic mechanism in the COPD asthma overlap syndrome. CYP11B2 is involved in steroid metabolism, which also made us very excited until we read some more, and it's really mineralocorticoid metabolism, such as aldosterone. Looking at just the non-Hispanic white subjects alone, there were two genes that were of interest but not genome-wide significant results, CSMD1 and SOX5, and these were also interesting because they've been shown to be associated with emphysema and COPD in previous publications. So to summarize our research in the COPD gene study, we found the asthma COPD overlap syndrome was common, about 12% frequency among this unselected group of COPD subjects, and more common in women and in African Americans. We found similar impairment in lung function despite less history of cigarette smoking, and I think that's important to know. So there's something else in these subjects that's leading to their airflow obstruction in addition to their cigarette smoking. Like the previous literature, we found these subjects had more symptoms and more exacerbations. And the bronchodilator responsiveness, although an attractive potential diagnostic marker, really did not distinguish between these two groups. On chest CT scan, there was less emphysema and more airway disease in the asthma COPD overlap subjects. In the genome-wide association study, we did not find any genome-wide significant results, but several interesting genes that we're going to follow up on. So what does this all mean? So even before there's a clear definition of this, people, or clear data to support a definition for this, people have been getting together and trying to come up with consensus statements and guidelines, and this was probably one of the best articulated ones from the Spanish Respiratory Society, which was published in 2012, and trying to act like rheumatologists, they came up with major and minor criteria for the diagnosis of that mixed asthma COPD phenotype. Major criteria are positive bronchodilator responsiveness, eosinophils in the sputum, and personal history of asthma. And minor criteria as well, and you need one of these and two of those and some other type of combination. And if you read through this paper, there's very little data to support this. It was more of a consensus between the experts that they got together. Other groups have also tried to come up with consensus definitions. The Japanese Respiratory Society in 2009 came up with it in their statement on COPD, has the diagnostic indices for concurrent asthma, including paroxysmal dyspnea, wheezing and coughing, atopy and eosinophil count. And the Canadian Thoracic Society in 2007 in their COPD guidelines highlight the importance of a FEV1 change greater than 400 mLs in bronchodilator response. Diurnal variability and peak flow, and then improvements in spirometry following inhaled oral steroids. So my impression of all these different consensus statements is we have no idea how to diagnose the asthma COPD overlap syndrome. So then how are we supposed to treat it? This, I actually think there is a bit more data and some more promise, because we've already been treating asthma and COPD the same way for quite a long time. There's a long history of using asthma medications in the treatment of COPD, including inhaled corticosteroids, long-acting beta agonist bronchodilators, and using oral corticosteroids for acute exacerbations. And more recently, and to my heart's delight, there's been a studies of COPD medications used to treat asthma, namely tiotropium. So this is data from the TORCH study, which is one of the first COPD mega trials studying combination of ICS and LABA in over 6,000 subjects with FEV1 less than 60%, and they were randomized to one of four arms, salmeterol and fluticasone in combination, or either of the two drugs alone compared to placebo, and they did not quite meet statistical significance for a mortality benefit from the combination therapy with a P of 0.052, so about as close as you can get without crossing over, but the subjects treated with the combination therapy did have reduced exacerbations and improved health status. But it's important to note that an explicit exclusion to the TORCH study was the diagnosis of asthma. There have been two more recent studies in the New England Journal about tiotropium in asthma. First one in 2010, where they looked at subjects who were poorly controlled on inhaled corticosteroids and found that tiotropium was superior to doubling the dose of inhaled corticosteroids and non-inferior to the adding LABA to the therapy. And then the second study was tiotropium versus placebo added to ICS LABA combination therapy and showed a reduction in asthma exacerbation rates. But it's important to note that both of these studies were limited to non-smokers, which they defined as less than 10 pack year lifetime smoking history. There has been one study in the asthma COPD overlap syndrome, a study of tiotropium published in 2008. They had almost 500 subjects and they used a physician diagnosis of the COPD asthma overlap, as well as bronchodilator response defined by the ATS criteria of 12% and 200 ml increase in FEV1. All the subjects in the study were already taking inhaled corticosteroids, and 70% were on LABAs as well, and then they added on tiotropium versus placebo to those subjects. The primary endpoint was the FEV1 area under the curve at 12 weeks, which tiotropium showed an improvement No surprise, tiotropium is a bronchodilator, causes bronchodilation. But they also showed something that may be more clinically relevant. There was reduced short-acting bronchodilator response, which is maybe a useful endpoint. However, the absolute difference between 1.8 puffs of salbutamol a day and 1.4 puffs of salbutamol a day is, again, unlikely to be a clinically significant difference. One interesting therapy that may have potential in this overlap syndrome is mepolizumab. It's an anti-IL-5 antibody, and it's shown to be effective in treating severe eosinophilic asthma, this guy right here. And there's three ongoing clinical trials right now in COPD, listed by their clinicaltrials.gov identifiers. But it's also important to note all three of these studies include subjects with a current diagnosis of asthma. So I think despite this more recent data in the COPD asthma overlap syndrome, there's more questions than answered. And I think there's a lot of questions about the diagnosis. We've been relying on a doctor's diagnosis in our research studies, and I think many of us in our clinical practice use that as well. But how reliable is that, especially knowing things like diagnostic bias and differential rates of spirometry use in different practice settings? Bronchodilator response is shown up in all the guidelines, but we've shown in our data that it's not really a reliable way to distinguish between these subgroups. We didn't discuss airway hyperresponsiveness at all, and that's partly because I'm coming at it from the COPD side of things, and most PFT labs will not perform bronchial provocation testing in subjects with reduced FEV1, including our lab, despite my having tried in the past. IgE levels are an interesting potential for diagnosis, but again, require more study. Sputum eosinophilia is probably useful, but again, how clinically applicable will that may be is up for debate. Chest CT scan showed differences, but again, no clear thresholds to distinguish. And then we didn't discuss other biomarkers like exhaled nitric oxide and then other potential, both exhaled and serum biomarkers that may help distinguish these two. This important subgroup. There's still many unanswered questions about the treatment. Inhaled corticosteroids and all the guidelines seem to be a first-line treatment for the asthma COPD overlap syndrome. We note that there's an increased risk of pneumonia in COPD patients treated with inhaled corticosteroids, and does that hold true in the asthma COPD overlap syndrome? We don't know at this point. In contrast, long-acting beta agonist bronchodilators have a black box warning in asthma. But in the COPD studies, they have not been shown to have any adverse effects like the asthma studies. So what about this asthma COPD overlap? Does this black box warning apply in that setting? And then what about other medications? So COPD medications such as roflumilast and macrolides that have been proven to be beneficial in COPD, and macrolides especially are being studied and may have some potential benefit in asthma. And then asthma medications like leukotriene modifiers and omalizumab, especially the latter, if we're talking about COPD with elevated IgE, we just don't have any data to guide the use there. So to summarize what we've talked about over the past 40 minutes or so, COPD is a heterogeneous disease, and I hope I've explained to you that spirometry is necessary, but it's beyond just spirometry. Asthma COPD overlap is a common subtype of this COPD, with subjects having increased symptoms and increased risk of exacerbations. Right now, the best definition we have relies on physician diagnosis, and bronchodilator responsiveness, although attractive, does not reliably distinguish between asthma COPD overlap and usual COPD. Treatment is generally similar to how we would treat asthma and COPD with inhaled corticosteroids, long-acting beta agonist bronchodilators, and tiotropium, but there really is a pressing need for further study of both diagnostic testing and treatment. So back to the case. The one or three cases we presented at the beginning. It's a 65-year-old man who came to you with a cough, worse at night, he's dyspneic when he's walking, he's needed antibiotics for exacerbations annually, and has notable past history of allergic rhinitis and childhood asthma, smoked for 40 years and quit 10 years ago, and has reduced lung function with some improvement following albuterol. So how would we diagnose this? And I would probably diagnose this person with the asthma COPD overlap syndrome. And how do we go out and treat this person? And that, again, is an area of question, but I think most people would use either inhaled corticosteroids, long-acting beta agonist combination, or tiotropium, or a combination of tiotropium and inhaled corticosteroids. And I think there's relatively few data to guide those nuances, but I think having that in mind and perhaps leaning towards inhaled corticosteroids earlier than we would in a traditional COPD is probably at least the current practice in what several guidelines recommend. So with that, I just wanted to acknowledge all the people who've worked on this, especially Megan Harden, who's couldn't be here today, but who did all the work in the COPD gene study, as well as other collaborators in COPD gene study here at the Brigham and elsewhere, plus all the other folks at the Channing Division of Network Medicine and throughout COPD gene, and the funding sources for these studies from the NHLBI and the National Institute of Nursing Research. So I'm probably done a little bit early, but happy to leave some time for questions and comments.
Thank you very much. And we do have time for questions, both from members of the audience or anyone watching on live webcasting who wants to submit a question electronically. Ed.
Greg, in looking at the patients that you described in the overlap syndrome, I would have guessed, without you actually showing data relevant to this, that they have an accelerated rate of overall lung decline over time. From the studies that you guys have done, have you shown evidence of that, given the fact that they have significantly more frequent exacerbations? Because if that's the case, this is a particularly problematic patient population from the perspective of healthcare utilization.
So yeah, I think that's a great point. And there,
can you repeat the question?
Sorry, the question was whether the subjects with the asthma COPD overlap syndrome have an increased rate of decline in lung function, which might be expected by their more frequent exacerbations. And this is something that Dr. Ingenito mentioned would be important for healthcare utilization and identifying that group. And the answer is we don't know. There really have not been enough studies of that. There are some hints that these subjects, perhaps with atopy or airway hyperresponsiveness, have increased lung function decline, but there really have not been longitudinal studies of this overlap syndrome. Hopefully, once we've brought back all the COPD gene subjects, we'll be able to specifically address that question. And as you know, in subjects who already have COPD, lung function decline is really a tricky question, since the most severe subjects don't tend to decline, or we don't see their decline because they don't come back if they decline too much. So we'll hopefully get at that question, but we don't have an answer right now. Yes?
Craig, that was a really great overview. And to kind of follow up a little bit on Ed's question, so are there data regarding the rate of decline in patients who are atopic or IIGEs over lifespan? You talk about following these people, but even just if you look cross-sectionally, are these the people who decline more quickly than the average COPD patient?
So the question was, are there studies of atopic subjects, and do they decline more quickly over the lifespan? So there is some equivocal evidence that subjects with atopy without COPD have a more rapid lung function decline, and that's part of sort of the Dutch hypothesis as well, but it has not been as clearly demonstrated for atopy as it has been for airway hyperresponsiveness. But once they hit the diagnosis of COPD, we really don't have that information. I mean, we would expect from our cross-sectional data that showed that these subjects were younger and still had the same level of lung function impairment, that there either has to be starting from a lower point or declining more rapidly or some combination of the two.
And if I could ask a second question, there have been reports in literature about patients with COPD having eosinophils when they get exacerbations. And is that a matter of actually patients who really have eosinophils all the time and we're seeing those patients have exacerbations? Or do you think there's a separate subtype, or there's a separate exacerbation pathobiology with eosinophils?
Yeah, again, that's sort of a great question. And these studies that have sort of identified the both stable and eosinophilic exacerbators have not specifically looked at whether they're sort of asthmatic at baseline, and I don't know if anyone's correlated sort of baseline in sputum eosinophilia and exacerbation sputum eosinophilia, and that's really an active area of interest for industry because of drugs that are targeting eosinophils, especially in these subjects with eosinophilic baseline inflammation or eosinophilic exacerbations.
You know, I couldn't help but think as you were showing your data, Craig, that if Elliot and Chris were looking at some of the characteristics of these overlap patients, they might look at them and say, these are patients from cluster 5 of the SARP asthma study. And you and I, being COPD physicians, look at it as, isn't this a unique COPD phenotype? I couldn't really get a good handle of how the patients you're describing in this overlap syndrome are different from what SARP identified in their severe asthma cluster 4 and 5 patients. They sound for all the world to be exactly the same patients.
I think they may be. I don't know what the smoking status of the SARP patients was.
This group smoked.
SARP excluded people with greater than 10 factors. Yeah. I'll tell you that whenever we try to look for severe asthmatics and we look at the populations being seen at the Asthma Center, 50% of the patients end up being excluded from our studies because they are patients who smoke more than 10 back years, but they're being followed with their severe asthma.
And diagnosed with severe asthma and treated as if they had severe asthma.
No, and I think, and you're not the first person who's brought up that parallel between this and SARP, and I think it would be an interesting thing to talk about, but that smoke, the difference in smoking is a major confounder there.
Have you guys gotten any biopsy samples on any of these patients in the overlap syndrome to look at their histology? Are samples like that available from any of your patients?
So we have not done that. There is some, when we presented this at ATS last year, a physician from Egypt came up to us and he said, here's my article that shows the asthma COPD overlap doesn't exist. Because if you biopsy all these patients, there's people who have asthma and people who have COPD, and there's nothing in between. And so his article said, it's easy to diagnose asthma and COPD. Just biopsy all of your COPD patients, which I don't think is really practical either in Turkey or Egypt or in the U.S. But no, we don't have that data.
So, Dr. Murphy.
Yeah, I think that's something that might help the situation. I've been working, believe it or not, for 40 years studying sounds in the chest, and we've developed computerized methods of separating COPD from asthma using high advanced techniques with a 16-channel system collecting sounds from that many sites, goes into the computer, and then multiple analyses studied and reported and published on ability of this device to separate COPD from normal and the various kinds of things you can measure, like decreased amplitude with respiratory phase, relationship with inflation, expiration, etc. And able to, using data mining techniques with the help of some folks from MIT, able to predict the difference between COPD and asthma with very high sensitivity, specificity, accuracy, and published. It's FDA approved. The problem I have now is getting funding to get more of these machines out so that they can be put in use. But the exciting thing is most recently, after having had a device that's very large and awkward, it's now we've advanced the technology so it's become much smaller and also wireless. So it's a Bluetooth situation. I don't matter, microphones in a separate computer, and be able to see the patterns of asthma and patterns of COPD pretty nicely without CT scans.
Can we ask Dr. Murphy, in your study of lung sounds using this 16-channel recorder, your ability to distinguish asthma from COPD, did you find any that seemed to have overlap?
Well, I haven't looked specifically at that, so I can't answer that question. But
No, that's exactly what I was going to say. I think it'd be very interesting to find these people with the clinical diagnosis of both and see if you can separate them or if they have...
data, and that could be looked at, so it's within the system here.
Okay.
You know, Craig, we didn't, having come at this from the COPD perspective, we didn't really talk at all today about the person with longstanding asthma who never smoked cigarettes and how somehow has developed irreversible obstructive lung disease. And even at their best with clear chest, they have reduced lung function. And do we see that as some also a asthma COPD overlap in that they have asthma with a component of irreversible airflow chest?
So, I mean, I think that sort of brings up the topic of non-smoking COPD from the COPD side of things. And what we really focused on today is the smoking or exposure-related COPD. So I think, for the most part, people, you and Dr. Israel, et cetera, are calling those people severe asthma. And I think the question is, if that person also smoked, and maybe even a minor smoking history, but more of the fixed airflow obstruction was from their chronic asthma, you know, I think we don't know the answer, but we have to presume that in these people who have, and for the most part, when we're seeing the 60, 70, 80-year-olds, the asthma may have been longstanding. It was definitely poorly treated because it was pre-inhaled corticosteroids when they were children. So how much of their airflow obstruction is due to the asthmatic changes, fibrosis, and how much is due to the COPD, we don't know, but I think it's an interesting question.
So can we take a question submitted electronically from Rumi Nusrat, who is a former Brigham a fellow in pulmonary and critical care medicine and infectious diseases. And he asked, is there any advance in understanding how better to treat patients with obstruction with or without significant reduction in DLCO? He's interested particularly in low DLCO. Mm-hmm. And any insights from the COPD gene study in the early identification or gene identification in patients with reduced DLCO?
So that's a good question. We really didn't discuss DLCO as a potential here. In COPD gene, we did not measure DLCO in visit one. We are doing it when they come back for visit two, so we will have some more information. But just knowing from the CT scans, if we use emphysema as a correlate of DLCO, there are definitely patients with obstruction without a lot of emphysema, and there are patients with a lot of emphysema and without obstruction. So I think this adds another level of complexity into the questions, and I think leads to more questions than answers regarding this.
All right, last question, Dr. Murphy.
Well, just coming back to lung biopsy, it seems to me a fairly abstruse way of doing things. You know, place in lung, and that doesn't reflect what might be going on many other places. So CT is obviously much better, but also is why I stayed with lung sound, because you can get them from many, many sites, just to see what the patterns are in each of the sites.
No, I mean, I think this whole idea of diagnosis is a really important one, and I think what we're probably, you know, if I were designing a study from scratch, I think I would collect all of these things: CT scan, DLCO, lung sounds, eosinophils, IgE levels, and try to figure out which of those best distinguish one group from the other, and perhaps there may be novel biomarkers that help us with this. But I think this is really something that has not been focused on enough, or at all for that matter, because many of the stakeholders are interested in either asthma or in COPD, but there's few that sort of care about the in-between. So I think there's some great questions to study there.
A perfect point to leave this at. Thank you very much, Craig.